Good morning to you. A happy Tuesday. It's Bruce and Judy with you. And, the spiderwebs. Yeah, I hear you on that one, all right? And by the way, we might get a little bit of rain a little bit later this afternoon. I even saw possibly some snow flurries again. Again, this second January sucks. Let's hurry up and get to April.
It never really stopped. We're not into spring yet.
God's sakes. Are you afraid of anything? Do you have any of these phobias or fears? Were you afraid of the dark? Maybe as a kid. Count me as one. I don't think I've ever had any phobia or fear. Spiders, heights, public speaking, snakes, cool. The dark? Oh, my God. But I think I have a pretty good reason for being afraid of the dark. We found out, there was a study out there that something like 70% of kids are afraid of the dark.
So much so they just call it a passage of youth, right?
It's kind of like part of growing up, I guess.
Absolutely.
So I remember when I developed a fear for the dark. We, as a family, I was probably 7, 8 years old. We went out to dinner. We come back home, and I kind of remember the weird sequence of events. We had, the garage door opener, and it didn't work. That's kind of weird. So we had, the key for it. You can open up the garage door. Okay. Then we go to the door inside that leads into the house, and it was locked. We never locked that door. When you got in your garage, you could go into the house. So what's going on? Open it up, and realize the back door is open, things are missing, the place has been robbed. So the burglars had gone inside and then locked all the doors so they couldn't get snuck up on, basically. And I remember that being the beginning of me, because it was nighttime, thinking, bad things happen in the dark.
Yeah, that I can see. Absolutely. That would be traumatic.
I had to have a night light. You turned all the lights off in a room, I would be apoplectic. I was like, no. I need a night light at all times.
Interesting.
At all times. I had those little bitty ones, those tiny little bulbs. I kept extra bulbs in next to the bed just in case. I had to replace a bulb, an emergency bulb in the middle of the night. Yeah. That I think I've gotten over it. I'd like to think
But that's really traumatic. You probably could have used some counseling. My kids always, I don't remember being afraid of the dark, and I wonder if it's because I slept with my sister.
So there was somebody there.
Yeah. We shared a room. We had bunk beds. I always had the top bunk, so I always figured,
they get the one on the bottom first.
Exactly.
Monsters are going to eat the lower one first.
So see, I don't have a fear of the dark as much as I do of fear of something happening. It just happens to be dark. I guess that's when things happen.
The bad things happen
bad
after
things,
dark.
Right, yeah, because even now, I have a lock on my bedroom door. Sometimes I lock my door.
Really?
So I figure, I guess I'll get my kids who are still at home before they get me.
Ouch.
But I do, my kids always needed a nightlight.
Yeah, I could not sleep.
I think it's just such a thing with kids, yeah.
In dark, I couldn't
even
do
if
it.
Nothing happens, like what happened to you, it's just... You shut the light off, and they're like, what's this?
I hated turning off the lights in my basement. So I'd be in the basement, and you turn, and you have
the switch at the bottom.
Yeah, you hit, and you timed
run.
It. Yeah, you timed, and you had to run, and then you went up the stairs on all fours.
You felt like there was this second where the light bulbs were like still going dark that you could get to the top of the stairs.
Yeah, before the monsters come out.
The
ones that hide where the you keep the all home vac, the single home vacuum system that was really too loud and scary.
Yeah, there's a lot of basements. Basements are terrifying to begin with.
That is hilarious.
Nothing ever really good happens in a basement, if we're going to be honest. That's usually where they find the bodies. That's where they find the bodies. They find the well, with the lotion and the dog.
So we had a hurricane. This is in Virginia, and I cannot remember which hurricane, but it was a big one. And we got so much rain that it flooded our basement. And when I say flooded, 3 to 4 feet of water in the basement. Not like a little bit.
Yeah, that's a flood.
And we We were begging to go swimming. We finally got a pool at the house. We've got an indoor pool. How will you not let us swim in this? And my brother and I would sit on the steps. It was about 8, 6, 7 steps up. You know, we'd sit there looking longingly into there, just going
at the sewer water. That's only, why you couldn't go in.
Only we could swim in that. Oh,
I remember we used to flood in Chicago in our 2 flat, and we would walk. I can't believe our parents let us go in it. I would never let my kids go in that water. Because it's a sewer backup. You do realize that?
No, it was a hurricane.
Okay.
It was water pouring in from the flooding outside. It was from the door.
So it was
we had
fresh
a door
water.
To our door to our basement. You know, like a what do you like a
it
stairwell?
Came up that from where? From the did you live by the ocean?
Yeah, no, it was just that much water. Yeah,
okay.
It was pretty crazy.
I would suggest
it is a hurricane.
Don't ever let your kids swim in.
Don't
any
let them
kind
do
of
that.
Flood water.
Do you have any phobias of your own? Are you afraid of snakes, spiders, heights, flying, anything?
I can't do heights.
Heights?
Even this on the 6th floor here, not too bad.
Really?
And I've I don't know if you've noticed because it's been over a year, I slowly made my way over to the window where I can now stand in front of the window.
Really?
That's how I have to do it. But I decided a couple years ago that I would, because that's my biggest fear.
Heights
that I would, and I have a couple other little ones, but that I would try to overcome those fears. That's been my
so stand next
I've
to the window on the 6th floor.
So I can, because it's about the sheer drop, right? I can look, like when I went to the Grand Canyon.
Oh God,
I could stand there and look.
Okay,
but I can't go to the edge.
Oh, and look straight down.
And it's so funny because I think people never really kind of believe you, like, oh, come on. But I literally
have a
physical reaction. I get dizzy, my head swims, and then I have that, whatever that thing's called, where you kind of want to jump off.
Okay. Wow.
A death wish?
Yeah.
Okay. A death wish. But I wouldn't, but there's something weird about
really?
What if I jump.
Like you don't trust yourself at the
right?
edge.
Right. But beyond that, I can't even get to the edge, really. So now I can get to the edge here and look out, and we're only on the 6th floor.
Hey, John in Joliet, how did you find out you were afraid of heights?
Yeah, good morning, guys. Yeah, a couple of years back, we decided to try zip lining on Fremont Street in Vegas.
Sure.
It was pretty fun from looking from the ground.
Looks like fun.
Until we got up there, and you lie down, and they strap you into the harness. And I'm like, you know what? I just can't do this. I just start getting feeling lightheaded and a little sick to my stomach. I just can't do this.
You found out while tied to the zip line in Vegas, I'm afraid of heights.
They were about to strap me in. I'm like, you know what? I can't do this.
Wow. Well, I'm glad you found out that as opposed to halfway down the zip line, for God's sakes. That could have been
terrifying.
Yeah,
because you would have passed out, and that would have been fun.
All right, John. Appreciate that. Yeah. So I developed, this is weird, I never thought I was claustrophobic. The fear of enclosed spaces. You know, I'm trapped in a glass booth of emotions. I think I developed claustrophobia. Like, I think, and I even asked a doctor about that. I go, can you develop these things? You know, because like you said, near a height or near a window or a sheer drop off, there's a physical response, your stomach, your head, your whatever. Mm-hmm. And I developed it sitting in the race car. In the race car, seatbelts tight, helmet on, and there was a time when I would get panicky, and I would like start sweating, and I'd have to undo the seatbelts and take my helmet off and like breathe, and it was because I'd been in the race car before, and I was like, can you develop claustrophobia? Like I caught it, like I caught the flu or something?
You caught it racing.
I caught claustrophobia.
And did he say you can?
Yeah, he says phobias can come and go like that, and conditions can come and go, and he also pointed out the fact that you've had eight closed head injuries probably doesn't help.
Yeah.
Because, again, my neurologist says no one's ever knocked sense into themselves. It's never happened.
Sometimes I feel like people can talk you into it, too, right? I had to undergo a full body scan one time.
Oh, in one of those, what is that machine?
Yeah, in
like a CAT scan?
MRI.
But a full, yeah. And I think what happens in those enclosed spaces, it's if you look...
Oh, yeah.
Either way, and you can't see.
Some people really freak out.
Oh, okay, but I didn't even think about it until someone was like, oh, you got to have one. And went on and on and on about it. So when I went in for it, totally flipped out.
Yeah.
Had to stop. I mean, that's a big deal to have a full body scan.
I kept my eyes closed. It's the only way I could do it.
And they should have told me that. And they put. And when you're having an MRI, they play this these loud noises. So they give you. They give you
like a white noise machine, like headphones.
Yeah, they give you headphones to cover it up. But you can still hear it. But had that person not said that, I think I would have been okay.
The MRI tech is the one who told me. Like,
yeah,
got me.
He did a good job.
Because, your nose is like a quarter of an inch from the edge of it.
It's like being in a coffin. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It is. I could not.
Oh, that's a good point.
Now, the one thing you could do is if you look down past
your nose?
Down your nose, you can see the opening at the end.
You can see freedom.
Wasn't enough. Was not enough. I had to get out of there.
Not enough at all. All right. Well, there you have it. Your phobia's out there.
And if you want a real unique one here from Chris and Joliet, I have sparkalophobia.
Sparkalophobia.
The fear of glitter. herpes of the arts and crafts
every
world.
Every parent's worst nightmare, actually.
Or you open up a card and it falls out. You're like, are you kidding me?
Who did this?
And why do I, when you guys say glitter, I think of something completely different.
Oh.
Really? You guys. All right. I do not think of arts and crafts. Hey, Bill O'Reilly is coming this Thursday night to the Genesee Theater, the world-famous Genesee Theater in Waukegan. We're going to be giving away some tickets in just a little bit. Get ready. You want to go hang out with Bill O'Reilly Thursday night? The No Spin Zone Live? Tickets are coming up in just a few. So, John Deere is a iconic brand, the green and yellow tractors, but they are facing a little bit of heat. But we got to drag Dink Gale into this over what has been come to known as right to repair. So if you don't know about right to repair, it's actually legislation that they are considering in Congress that prevents a manufacturer of anything. I don't care if it's a phone or a tractor. From making it impossible for the owner to fix it themselves, having some sort of proprietary software or a tool that they don't sell, whatever it might be, you know, and there's a fundamental argument because John Deere is now, listen, facing complaints from farmers who say they can't fix their own tractor. It's required to go to an authorized technician because they can't access the software.
Right. It's a software diagnostic tool. And, even worse, they have to go to a John Deere dealer. And in some cases, there's like one authorized dealer in a county.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
You know, you've got like 6,000 farmers in a county. And it's, you know, one farmer was in the story was saying you have to wait 32 days just to, you know,
even get in. Well, parts are difficult.
Oh, yeah. And just to get it.
Employees and.
Yeah, I mean, these farmers could probably fix it themselves if they had the necessary equipment, right? Mm-hmm. If they knew how. But
or
John
if they
Deere
had
makes
access
it impossible.
To it. Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. You know, farmers are a pretty ingenious lot in and of themselves. They like to fix everything, do things by hand, and then you run into something as important as a tractor.
Yeah.
For your farm, and you're not allowed to fix it yourself. You can't.
Right.
It literally is locked out. And again, it's a fundamental debate. This right to repair if you are the end customer, you bought it, whatever it is, shouldn't you be able to fix it without being forced to go to the only person on the planet who can still fix it? I mean, I understand why companies do it. Heck, that's a heck of a revenue generator. Don't worry. I can't change the oil on that thing because we put a special drain plug on it that can only be opened by one of our technicians.
Yeah.
You know, okay, well, great. You get to charge me then to do something that normally I would be able to do on my own.
Well, and you wonder, would people buy the deer then if they knew that? If they knew that they could only, you know, when you're going in to buy a, God knows how much, $80,000 tractor, whatever it costs.
$1 million tractor.
And do they tell you, by the way, can't go anywhere else, get this fixed? No, of course not. So maybe you wouldn't buy it there if you knew that. I mean, that's the other part of this too. Yeah, John Deere enjoys, you know, some pretty loyal customers, right?
Very loyal customers.
Yeah. Maybe not until they hear this.
Well,
not until
this,
they can't get their tractor fixed.
This has been a complaint for a long time. And even before you get into the computer systems that these tractors have these days, there were specialty tools that sometimes were unavailable.
Yeah.
I mean, so in those cases, yeah. And so And farmers are very smart. Farmers are very, I mean,
ingenuity,
right, yeah. And they can fix damn near anything.
Right.
But with these tractors, so I think it's about time that they have, you know, filed something with the FTC.
Well,
or somebody.
And you know, if, I mean, only because of the complexity of them, I guess I'd say cars are kind of near the top of the list of this where, sure. where,
But you and I can go to an auto parts store and buy the diagnostic tool for $30, plug it into the OBD2, mm-hmm. scan it and say, oh, my oxygen sensor's bad.
Right.
You know?
But the, and that isn't necessarily the fundamental problem. The other, the extension of that is, that there are vehicles out there, John Deere's not the only one, and I don't mean to beat up on them more than others, that the code it throws off
right.
is nothing you can you Cipher. Can't access right. And do anything with. Or, like you said, there is a specific tool that is unique only to the dealership, if you will, the manufacturer, and you can't access the part that broke or went wrong.
Right.
And I mean, it is, iPhones are that way. You open up an mm-hmm. iPhone and you've ruined it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's been one of the arguments like, well, wait a minute. Shouldn't I be able to open up the damn iPhone? I bought it. It's my phone. I'm not borrowing it from iPhone, you know, from Apple. Why can't I repair my own iPhone? Why am I forced to go to you guys? Because yeah. you're the only ones that have
it's
the little
competition.
Thing. You know, mm-hmm. the little screws on the back of it. You can't open it up without them. So that's one of the right to repair out there. So, you know, when you think about that, though, there's so much tech out there, so much different tech. What's the oldest piece of tech you use? Does anybody still have like a
rotary you know, phone?
What do you
think? Does that count?
I have answering a rotary machine? Phone.
You got an answering machine?
Oh my god! One of those.
I've got a tape player, like a little tape recorder yeah. and player that I use to play my singles on.
I think AM got, radio.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Reporters still use. Tape recorders, don't they, Nick?
Tape recorders.
I think Bob Roberts was the last one to still use.
Yeah. Can you buy the tapes? I think that's the issue,
oh, yeah,
right?
Of course.
My tape recorder works great. Where do you get the tapes?
The last time I was out as a reporter, I was using a tape recorder.
EMD 222, the Marantz deck.
The Marantz, yeah. Beautiful. Those are so nice and heavy. So heavy.
Other reporters.
I don't even know that I. What do I have? Do I have a beeper? No. I have a really old iPad.
I have a first generation iPad that doesn't.
Well, you know, all of a sudden you're playing, like I was playing Candy Crush one day, and then all of a sudden it said, yeah, sorry, it's not supported anymore.
Yeah.
Like, well, what? I'm at level like 5,000. What do you mean? And it just goes away. That's the weird thing.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah.
They're like,
gotta
buy a new one. You're out.
Got to get a new iPad. I refuse. I still have it.
That'll
it just
teach
sits
them.
There and I look at it sometimes.
It's a paperweight. Yeah.
You know.
Fancy.
You can beat any invaders with it. Any home invaders.
with your exactly. iPad.
Yeah. In the dark. When I go turn off the basement lights, I usually take it down with me.
I mean, so many of these things
that's how big it is.
Have planned obsolescence built into them. But there's some of that old stuff we you know, you still use. There's some of that old stuff we still have around.
I don't know that if I told my kids to go plug in the phone... Go plug in the landline. They would be like, what do you mean? They'd walk around the house.
Even
the
little
cord.
Plug.
They like, don't even know where that plug is.
It doesn't look like a USB.
I think we have
what
one
that?
In the
oh,
house.
Oh, really?
I think
in the entire house?
In the entire house. I've only seen it in one place.
I don't think I have any in my place.
I left it there because I thought it was very retro.
Wait till you explain to them the concept of dial-up. That you can't be on the computer at the same time as you're chatting on AOL.
Hey, I'm downloading music off Napster. I've got 3 more hours to go before I get the Limp Bizkit song.
Oh gosh, those were the days.
God, you people
out there. By the way, those were the days just a couple years ago.
Still time for our criminal of the day. I got to give a shout out to newlyweds Stephanie Genus and John Gerhard of Newport, North Carolina, who took the vow, for better or worse, till death do us part, literally, roughly 3 hours after saying, I do. Allegedly, the happy couple had retreated to the honeymoon suite at their hotel after a joyous wedding in front of friends and family. With the marital glow wearing off quickly, a dispute over Stephanie's brother began that quickly turned violent. Police were called and found Miss Genus in the hotel lobby, still wearing her wedding dress, but now it was bloodstained and torn. Sounds like a horror movie. Stephanie suffered, quote, a bloody nose, busted lip, and swollen eye during the altercation, while John, who had seen better days, said that his new wife and headbutted him, causing a cut on the bridge of his nose, swelling on his face, and bloodied his rented pants. The couple each told police they were the primary aggressor. At least they agree on something. So both were arrested and charged with domestic battery and spent their wedding night at the Collier County Jail. There's a story for the grandkids. So instead of consummating your wedding after exchanging vows, you exchange punches, kicks, and headbutts. You, Stephanie Genus, and John Gerhardt are the Bruce St. James Show criminals of the day. All suspects described above should be considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law, no matter how crazy they are. Hey, good morning to you. Happy Tuesday. Here's what's coming up this hour. Feeling a few aches and pains? Break out the family photos? We'll tell you why nostalgia might be the best medicine at 6:45.
Your new 11th Ward alderman has been confirmed, but is the historic appointment overshadowed by her family history? We'll talk with Axios Chicago at 6:30.
And the secret to your economic well-being is hiding in your top drawer. The economics of underpants in just a few minutes. But first, police have been retiring in high numbers. Is the Chicago Police Department facing a crisis amongst its senior officers? It's referred to as the brain drain. Let's see, with the last year alone, 660 police officers retired. That's twice as many as pre-pando levels. We had the story this morning, Nick Gale's on top of it. Two more officers attacked, apparently just completely kind of out of the blue type thing. First tried to run over with the car and then shot at. It makes me wonder, how are we going to replace the retirements? How are we going to replace this? Who wants to be a cop today?
Well, that's the problem.
Who's going to sign up for this job?
I mean, believe me, there used to be a time where, you know, they had to turn people away. The academy.
Oh, yeah,
the
so
academy.
Many
oh,
people
so many
applying.
Applicants. Absolutely. I don't know what that's like these days. That many retirements is a lot. Now, you know, hopefully the city prepared for that a little bit. Sometimes you don't know because people stay on past their retirement age, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I would assume that this has been going on long enough that the city has, you know, been making some plans for it, because that's a lot of officers.
The normal attrition rate is 3-5% of the force mm-hmm. quits, retires, whatever they choose every year. We're now at 8.5%. You know, we are at a pretty staggering number, and this becomes a concern if you understand a little bit about how policing works. If you're losing the officers, if you're losing sergeants, lieutenants, captains, are the officers underneath ready for promotion, or are they just being pushed into jobs? And what does that do for a police force overall? Right. And then you lose somebody off the street. Like, you can see where this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy at some point.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to be qualified, right? There, you know, again, we've heard the stories for years, for decades, about how tough those tests are to even become a sergeant and lieutenant. And yeah, so that's the brain drain they're talking about. It's hard to, you said it earlier, it's gotta be a lot harder to want to be a cop these days.
Who would sign up today?
I mean, because I've always said, I think police officers, there's something special about police officers. You know, it's not a job. You just go, well, maybe I'll be a cop.
You know,
it sounds like a good job. It's a calling. You have it, something in you that wants to be a police officer, that wants to serve the public, right? These days, there's a good chance you're going to use there used to be a time not too long ago where some officers never even shot their gun.
Oh, I'm still.
I think even, yeah, most officers, let's say.
Never pull their gun.
Many, many, many more officers these days do shoot their guns. Many more officers get shot. It was so rare to have a police officer shot that when it happened around the country, it was a big story. I mean, not that it still isn't. It's just that it happens so much more.
Too often.
And you've got to think twice. Even if it's your calling, I think people are like, I mean, there's a good chance I'm going to, you know, use my gun. A gun might be used against me. You know, it's indicative of what's happening around the country.
Is it nepotism then that's going to keep people in there? I've heard a lot of people, like, my dad was a cop, my granddad was, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like,
oh, yeah. it's definitely a family business tradition.
You know, and kind of like the military where, you know, you maybe have more of a propensity to do it. But that becomes an issue in and of itself, because we hear a lot about the term community policing, police officers who live in, grew up around their community, as opposed to just come in from somewhere else and wave a billy club and go home at night.
Yeah, I mean, you'd hate to think that we're going to be forced to do, you know, like a rent-a-cop situation. I don't know what they're going to do.
Well, how are they recruiting, and can you recruit in some of these neighborhoods? Can you get people to sign up for a career? Getting back to, who would want to be a police officer?
Right, especially in some of those neighborhoods where they live, and they see what's going on, and they're like, And the whole family thing. If I'm a police officer and my daughter wants to become a police officer these days, I'm thinking to myself, I'm afraid.
Well, and that probably drives a lot of the new data out there that says a large share of Americans want more spending on law enforcement, more spending on police. Now, I would say I have no problem with that at face value. That also means higher taxes. Like, again, it comes from somewhere. You can't have your cake and eat it too. Mm-hmm. Like, you got to pay for it. We want more of this and lower taxes. And I'm for lower taxes. Let's be clear. So whatever that means is what it means. But if you want, you know, 1,000 more Chicago cops, who's going to pay for it? You know, somebody's got to pay for it. So keep that in mind a little bit. But certainly,
if you can even find 1,000 more cops.
Right. But I think certainly the rise in crime, the issues, the stories that we keep hearing on a regular basis, whether it's a carjacking or a shooting, I think more and more people are saying, I need police officers. I need more of them. And I think, you know, one of the narratives out there that is not true from anybody we've talked to is, especially in some of these violent neighborhoods, think South and West Side, the residents want more cops. They're not anti-police. They want to go to sleep at night and not worry about a bullet coming through their front window. They want to be able to walk down the street, or their children walk to elementary school and not be a victim of violence. We hear from them the loudest. Yes, we want police. Yes, we need more of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, it's just a matter of, I think that's, I'm hoping it doesn't, but it's almost slowly becoming a thing of the past that people want to, you know. Being a police officer used to be this, you know, a high standard kind of job that not everyone could do.
Yeah.
And you know, you have to also say, I mean, the pandemic had to have had an effect, right? As it did across the board in all jobs.
Every industry.
Every people just took stock of their lives, and they, you know, they decided to move on to retirement or to whatever. And I think, you know, many times, especially with police officers, because they can retire fairly early, you know, a lot of them either stayed on or they took retirement, but then came back as a, you know, advisor, whatever. I mean, they do these other sort of jobs, and it just seems like now they're just walking away. They're not, you know, away from the industry.
Well, it is a brotherhood. You know, there is a brotherhood to it. And I would say, similar to the military, I've heard talk about, like, you know, if you leave the job, if you walk away, if you retire early, whatever it is, have you left your brothers in a vulnerable position? You know, have you left them behind in some way, shape, or form? Will backup be longer to get there now because they aren't replacing them? They aren't the line of people coming out of the academy to replace the officers that are leaving now. And so I got to believe that's a bit of a pull on some of the more senior officers thinking, you know, I leave now, well, who comes when he calls? You know, yeah. My buddy, you know, my best friend out there who's wearing a badge and a gun as well.
And it's interesting because they, like I said, I think they can retire at 50. Not that they did, not that many did, but now I think a lot do. And that's young.
Yeah.
These are, when you think about it, people who could still, now they've been on the job a long time too, and there's that. How long do you stay a police officer? It's not an office
in Chicago,
job. It's not a desk job. Yeah. But, you know, that's the problem. They're not that old, and they're losing that whole chunk of what they call the brain power. It takes a long time to get back to that, too, to become a sergeant and a lieutenant. And I think you have to have a certain number of years in. It's going to be tough. And you would only hope that the city has been preparing for this. This is, you know, the pandemic really ramped things up, but this has been going on for a while in Chicago.
WLS presents the No Spin Zone with Bill O'Reilly. That's right. Coming live this Thursday night to the Genesee Theater in Waukegan. That's right. The No Spin Zone live with Bill O'Reilly. You can still get tickets at WLSAM.com. Or how would you like to win free tickets? We got those coming up in just a little bit. Sponsored by attorney Stephen A. Leahy of Open Tax Advocates. All right. So stick around. We'll give you some free Bill O'Reilly tickets coming up. Again, this Thursday night. So what can men's underwear teach us about the economy? Yes, Alan Greenspan. Yes, that Alan Greenspan. Just in case there's a different one. No, the former head of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, says that the sales of men's undergarments is a good predictor of a recession.
Yeah, apparently you guys in hard times will forego buying new underwear.
I forego buying new underwear all the time. Like, I don't, it's not recession based for me.
What is it?
Well, you're a guy. You wear underwear until it, like, literally falls off right. of you. I mean, some of us right now are possibly wearing just a band of elastic. It's all that's really left of the thing, right?
Times are tough.
Yeah.
You're not buying it, but because it's a downturn in the, that signals a downturn in the economy.
Do guys buy their own underwear, or do girls buy underwear for them? I get a sense, like, if you have a woman in your life, you're like, okay, I've had enough of that underwear. Okay, this isn't lucky underwear anymore.
Sure, sure.
I will say my boys would, for a while, they were requesting underwear for like Christmas. Okay. So I would get it because, you know, they know I probably will spend a little bit more on it maybe. Or maybe like they just don't buy underwear.
Yeah, it's not something I think about buying very often.
No.
Like you're not walking to the store going, ooh, look, the underwear.
Yeah.
You know, look at the new colors. The new fall colors are in.
But when you look at your tattered underwear you're putting on, do you say, might be time for new underwear?
No, because I don't think anybody sees it.
Yeah.
Mm. Exactly. Do you have a lot of underwear?
I'm wearing underwear for me, not for you. What?
But what about the comfort? You know, you want to make sure that you're not wearing tattered underwear.
Well, tattered doesn't. No, the looser and more, you know, free flowing it is, the better.
Yeah. I like a form fit.
Oh, okay. Do you guys have a lot of underwear, or do you have just a couple pairs?
What's a lot?
Yeah. I've got at least one
for every day?
Oh, no. Oh, got seven pairs?
You don't have seven pair of underwear?
You can turn them inside out and wear them again.
No. Seven pairs of underwear?
Oh, God.
Maybe five or so?
I've got a week and a half worth.
A week and a half of underwear?
Probably about a dozen, I would think.
A dozen.
Okay, Bruce.
I am falling behind. I've been in my own recession, apparently, for quite some time.
Yeah, I think you've waited enough years.
This idea. I need to go down to the Costco and get myself a 30-pack. You know?
I probably have 30 pair.
Wow.
And I don't even wear underwear.
So there are other bizarre, underwear being one of them, bizarre indicators of
economic times.
Here's one. The consumption of beer index.
Well, I got to imagine that goes up as things get worse.
Yes. Absolutely. Well, they say this has to go at with home. Going out. Because people tend to save money and drink at home during harder times and not go into bars and restaurants and order what could be more expensive. Oh, yeah. They don't necessarily cut down on it. They just change the way they consume it.
Right. It's got to be more. I mean, I have so many more bottles of wine in my house than this? I ever have.
Aspirin and Tylenol usage. Sales of aspirin and other headache medications increase as the economy gets worse, as people try to deal with their stress. Back in 2008, Advil had its biggest year ever. There's an actual index of headache medicines to bad economy.
Parents of small children, so diaper rash ointment goes up. Because they keep the diaper on longer.
Oh, I was trying to get the connection there.
Because diapers are expensive. And, of course, then diaper sales go down. Yeah, they keep the diaper on longer, leading to a little bit of rash, but it's cheaper to buy the ointment than new diapers.
All right, you ready for this one? The population of alligators. How do alligators affect the economy? When fewer people buy high-end bags made out of alligator or crocodile? Well, the alligator farms basically end up with a whole bunch of bleeping alligators, and nobody wants to turn them into a belt or a handbag.
Or boots.
Oh, or boots.
Okay, this one is really sad. People don't go and claim bodies at the morgue.
Oh.
Because if you don't claim the body...
What happens?
Well, the state or the city or the county buries them. Probably
yeah.
The county.
In like, in like a pauper's grave.
Yeah, pauper's grave.
They still have that.
Oh, yeah.
I believe so, yeah.
You didn't put your name on it? I'm just planning for the future.
No. And they don't... They probably don't even go in a box. They just dump you right in the hole.
That's a thing, huh?
Yeah, a pauper's grave or a potter's ground, if you've ever heard that. Potter's
really?
Ground is just on large tracts of cemetery land that are unmarked.
They still do that.
Well, they have to. There are... Many, many cases where...
Unclaimed?
Yeah, people don't know their loved ones have died or they've lost touch.
But in this case,
they do know their loved ones.
Yeah.
They're loved, I'm doing that in air quotes.
We're
ones
use,
have
yeah.
died.
Liked
and they're
one.
Like, you know, Uncle George had a good life.
How
he's
much
so
is it to
old.
Bury you?
He doesn't really care.
Oh, my
funerals
God.
Funerals have
got to
be expensive.
It's like 10 grand.
Whoa!
Minimum.
Minimum. It's probably more
that's
15,
minus
20.
A burial plot. Right?
Yeah, that's them putting you in a cardboard Amazon box that they had a couch delivered in and then tossing you into the lake. That's 10 grand.
Yeah.
10 grand for that.
Yeah.
So it reminds me of there was a book called Die Broke. It was a very popular book back in the day, kind of like, you know. The idea was that, and I remember the subtitle was, the goal is that the last check you write is for your funeral, and it bounces. Die broke. Okay, that is the goal, and I'm still operating under that goal. And a good morning to you. A happy Tuesday. Bruce and Judy with you right now. And, well, has the race for the next mayor of Chicago just gotten a little bit more interesting? Joining us right now from Axios Chicago is Justin Kaufman. Good morning to you, Justin.
Good morning, Bruce. How are you, bud?
I am rip-roaring ready to go. So who is the latest name that we're going to throw their hat into the ring for potential challenging Mayor Lightfoot?
Well, it was revealed last week that text message polling was happening for a very familiar name in Chicago, Congressman Mike Quigley. Mike Quigley is, of course, the congressman in the 5th District, which represents parts of the suburbs and, of course, the entire north side of Chicago. Now, Mike Quigley was a Cook County Board Commissioner for years before he took over the 5th Congressional District in a special election in 2009 from Rahm Emanuel.
Oh.
Mike Quigley is a very prominent, a very vocal name for the Democrats on Capitol Hill right now. He serves on the Committee for Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
He also has been on the Intelligence Committee, played a big role in both impeachments of President Trump. So there's a lot to say about Mike Quigley, especially when it comes to name recognition in Chicago.
Yeah, we spoke to him just the other day about Ukraine.
Yeah, and I feel like Mike Quigley's—he's well liked in this area at least, and I think probably on Capitol Hill. I mean, he has a pretty good reputation, wouldn't you say?
He does, right? I mean, he's been known to Chicago. He's a guy who has balanced, I think, his sort of political career of being a national voice in Congress and also a local voice. You're gonna see him. Like I said, on committees like Intelligence and Homeland Security. And then you're going to see him at groundbreakings on the north side. He was just at the groundbreaking for the Howard Brown Center on North Halsted neighborhood. So he does have a lot of name recognition and a lot of profile, and he would be a formidable opponent because of the nature of where he represents. He's well-liked. He's been reelected without any concern for the last decade, and he represents the north side of Chicago, which is a huge swath of area that you need to be mayor of Chicago.
Justin Kaufman is with Axios Chicago. Yeah, I went and looked it up because, you know, like, whenever you hear about congressmen or senators leaving, you're like, well, are they leaving because they're vulnerable? You know, I'm going to retire so that they don't lose their next election. In 2020, Quigley got almost 70% of the vote. I mean, he was wildly popular in his district, so he's not bowing out, if you will, to run for mayor, if that's what he does, because he's in a vulnerable seat. He must really want to do this.
Yeah, and you know, another thing, too, when you think about, the 5th District is
positively Democrat. And like I said, before Mike Quigley, it was Rahm Emanuel. Before Rahm Emanuel, it was Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
Yeah, who took over, who was a congressman when he ran for governor. I forget the year exactly when he ran. But, yeah, so, I mean, and it's also the, I mean, it is such a Democratic seat that it was Dan Rostenkowski's seat for years in the 80s and 90s in Chicago. So it's a powerful seat on Capitol Hill, but it's also a powerful seat in Chicago. The thing is, if you're going to win in the city of Chicago for mayor, and they showed this when they map when the elections are over, you have to win the gut. You have to win Lincoln Park, Lakeview, Rogers Park, Wrigleyville, those kind of neighborhoods to have a chance. Now, the mayor, to be fair, right now, Mayor Lightfoot swept all of that in 2019. Mm-hmm. It was hers. Tony Preckwinkle, the Cook County Board President who ran against her, she did not do well. So this is Mayor Lightfoot. Bread and butter is the lakefront liberals in the north side of Chicago, because that's why it's a formidable opponent, because it would definitely dig into that majority she's had there.
Wow.
And has Lightfoot announced that she's running for re-election?
She has not. And I think it's probably a formality, because right now everyone's focusing on the June primary for the midterms for the Illinois state races. She's raising money actively. Mm. She's sending out emails and she's doing fundraisers, things like that. But right now she is publicly not. Announced that she's running for re-election. There are other people too. I mean, Vincent Willie Wilson, perennial candidate.
Yeah,
it'd be interesting. You know, he just gave him like $1.2 million in free gas.
That's going to be his entire platform. Vote for me. Yeah. I give away free gas. You could win on that.
Oh gosh, yeah.
I will say this, Bruce. Eric Zorn pointed this out in his newsletter, that a lot of those gas stations were in Cook County, so it's an easy thing to say, oh yeah, he's running for Chicago mayor. He's just giving away free gas. But it's interesting. Those are not Chicago voters that he gave away that gas to. So I don't know if it is politically voted. Maybe just he wants to give back to people in Chicago or in the Cook County area. But Paul Vallis, the superintendent, the former CPS CEO, his name has been surfaced as well as somebody who continually is very critical of this administration, the Lightfoot administration, and could be on the ballot come 2023.
Wow. Well, the city is changing, the makeup of it's changing, and maybe no better example of that is at the city council, where yesterday the history was made, might be a good way to put it, as Nicole Lee became the alderwoman for the 11th Ward, the first Asian-American woman to serve on the city council. Now, it's been pointed out, and far be it for me, congratulations to her, but she does have some political ties as well. You know, her background is interesting.
Yeah, she's the daughter of Jean Lee, who was a machine Democrat in the Chinatown area for years. And that Jean Lee worked for Mayor Daley. He also represents a more centrist Democrat in the Chinatown area. It's interesting. We're doing a piece for Axios tomorrow on Chinatown politics. It doesn't get talked about as much as some of the other neighborhoods in Chicago just because of representation. We just saw a huge fight for the ward remap, which is being sent to the ballot on June 28th, about giving Asian Americans the majority in the 11th ward, which now will be represented by Nicole Lee. Yeah, but she, you know, she's kind of her own person. I don't know how much of a connection she has to her dad. And if you listen to Mayor Lightfoot, Mayor Lightfoot wants us to specifically understand that she does not have a connection to her dad.
Yeah. So
it's very funny how she kind of admonished the media who asked her questions about that. But it's not a progressive hire. I mean, the Lee family there, especially her dad, are much more Chicago machine politicians than the progressive politicians that we've seen in the recent times. Mm.
And so that's why it's funny that Lightfoot would even say that, because, you know, that's what you expected from her, to push a more progressive candidate, and then she went with same old, same old.
Yeah, and I mean, Nicole Lee has a great background in the Chinatown area, and she's been in the private sector, she's been a little bit in the public sector, so it makes sense. I don't think it's that controversial of a pick for someone in the 11th Ward, but, you know, if you're going to be in the family of people who've been in the Chicago machine, who have had some dirt in their past, it's going to come up when you want to take on public office. We see that with any politician.
I was going to say, Justin, name one and you can do the family tree, and it probably leads to a penitentiary somewhere. You know, I mean, it seems to be kind of par for the course. Although, you know, this this new Alderwoman Lee does show and kind of gets back into that whole, the redistricting, the map, what is it going to look like? How representative is the city council for the actual population as opposed to the population some people wish it was?
Yeah, and you know what? It'll be really interesting to see come the election, which is just, you know, in February of 2023, what happens with Chinatown politics. Will Nicole Lee have in 10 months a challenger that is more progressive? Will we start to understand a little bit more of the demographics of that voting block? It's going to be interesting and I think a great show for Chicago because, like we said, there hasn't been representation in the past. Mm. It's not a monolith. We know that about all politics. So it'll be interesting to see the Asian American majority ward that is the 11th ward and how it plays out with politics when we hit our municipal election in just under a year.
Well, it'll be interesting to see your article tomorrow on that because we don't haven't focused in Chinatown very much. Yeah. So, someone new to set our sights on.
There you go. Axios Chicago, the place to be. Thank you very much, Justin. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Bruce. Thanks, Judy.
Thank you.
Yeah. Seriously, if you want to know what's going on in the city, it's an absolute must read every day. You check out Axios. And a good morning to you. A happy Tuesday. You know, you can join the Big 89 of the Links and Drinks Open Golf Outing, sponsored by DuPage Credit Union. It's going to be Friday afternoon, June 3rd. Oh, what a day to play hooky. We're going to be at the Klein Creek Golf Club in Winfield for a best ball scramble tournament. We'll all be there. We'll have lots of fun, tons of prizes, and a good time out on the course. You might even break out the sticks. You never know what happens, all right? I just don't want to have to play John Howell.
Or Kim Gordon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
She's really good.
Phenomenal. You got to be on the damn tour, for goodness sakes. So, you know, when times get tough, people can get stressed out. You can get pain, aches, soreness. And maybe you reach for, we saw that we talked earlier about the Advil scale, the Tylenol scale, that people might reach for something, but maybe instead of reaching for a pill to get rid of your pain, there's something else you have. It's in a drawer. It's probably in a box.
Maybe in a book, an album, as you call it.
Old pictures. How can old pictures help reduce pain?
Nostalgia. That's that sentimental feeling of longing for the past. Scientists say that can reduce pain perception.
Really?
So when you're in pain, you start looking at old photos, they found that it eases the pain.
Especially brings when back it's like happy memories, or just hopefully you're distracting yourself maybe.
Well, yeah. And then I was thinking, well, take it a step further and go do something nostalgic. Will that even help more? Like, you know, when I go to carnivals are really nostalgic to me because...
Like the old neighborhood carnival.
Right, in Chicago, back in the day, every Catholic school had its own carnival.
Sure.
And we just went on the carnival run the whole summer. We were carnies. But it's so when I go to a carnival, I always feel good. And I mean, I guess I get it, right? Even if you look at a picture, you feel good. You're happy. You smile. It eases the pain, but maybe you're right. Maybe you do forget about it.
Other things like that work, you know, that like music, maybe of your youth or of a better time.
Right.
You know, music can soothe the savage beast,
when I hear
a song, right?
When I hear Me and Mrs. Jones.
For example, for you, for me
example,
and Mrs.
For
Jones.
Me, that's my trigger. Because there are triggers,
it's
too,
a positive
right?
One.
Yeah, absolutely. I always feel good, and I sing it at the top of my lungs if I'm in the car.
I think there's a danger with the pictures, though. And I found this out because of the Facebook, where on Facebook you have the thing called memories.
Okay, I kind of love and hate that.
So sometimes the memories, I'm like, oh, yeah. And other times I'm like, son of a mother, who the hell? Should have deleted that.
Yeah, I've been using Facebook since I was about 15.
Yeah.
And those are starting to come back around again.
Yep.
Yeah, I wish I could delete my entire teenage years.
You don't like the picture? You don't like the event? You don't like the person?
Oh, I don't like... If by person you mean me, then yes. Because all the cringy, weird, mid to late 2000s stuff I used to put on social media, I wish someone had hit me and taken away my computer.
Mm.
It's so embarrassing.
Not nostalgic for that. Well, that's interesting. I love them. I mean, I sometimes hate the way I look at them because, like you said, they go back. But for the most part, those memories are all good.
They can be.
But you younger people, you have memories now that you wish you hadn't. I get that. I don't really.
You don't have that. How many photos of you guys you have from when you were like 15, 16 years
old? A lot, but none of them online.
None online, though. That's
really
important.
I have a ton. I have a whole dresser filled with photo albums. I'm a photo album person, though. Even to this day, I like to do photo albums.
Do you like it just because so physical?
I like
product,
to look at
right?
them. Yep,
you
know? And I like to look at them.
I have it somewhere. That might be part of the problem that I can't exactly tell you where it is. But as a Christmas present, I think. My mom, for my brother and I, did a photo album of, like, you know, baby's first picture, kind of like through modern times. She put all the pictures together, kind of chronological, but pictures that some of them I'd never seen before because they'd been in some shoebox that mom had in the underneath her bed or wherever parents keep pictures, you know?
Yeah.
So I have that, which is kind of cool, but I don't, ever since like digital, I don't know where pictures are.
But see, the thing with digital, I tend to get rid of them after a while because it gets too full, right?
Oh, well, I save them.
You have
them
no
all.
More space. Oh,
I have like, on the Google photos
or whatever. Yeah, I don't. I just
is.
Print them out then at that point. I like to have, so my albums are like events. This is when we went to Florida. This is when we went to Sedona. This is when we went to the lake house. You know, this was Christmas of whatever year. So I like to, and my daughter likes to look at them. Yeah, there's something about looking at it's like reading an actual physical book, right? Rather than doing an audio book. It's something about having that in my hand, and I enjoy it. And apparently it takes away my pain.
Right.
That I didn't even know I had. Yeah.
All right. It would make me feel more emotional pain, maybe. Take away that crick in my neck.
Physical pain because I'm crying?
But that's the thing, too. If you look back sometimes on pictures and you're like, oh, there's my dead husband.
Ouch.
You know what I mean? Yeah,
true.
I would think the pain would come back in full force.
Well, you tend to remember the nice thing. You know, like if I look at a picture of my dad, and when I look at a picture of my dad, I do, like, I miss my dad, but it's like, oh, it's so nice to look at a photo of. Like, I keep a photo of him on my mantelpiece, and it's nice to just look every once in a while. And yes, it's sad, but at the same time, it's like, you know, he's still right there. You can take a look and just be like, yeah, I miss dad, but I also love dad.
And we're humans. We, believe me, take great pains to remember the good things and forget the bad things.
We do tend to have that ability. Thank you to, kind of block out maybe some of the bad. But then again, for me, things like Facebook memories, brings back all the bad, and I'm like, what was that?
It's so funny. I wait for those every day. Like, what's today? Oh, let's see what today brings.
Really.
Sometimes I look like with braces on. Oh God.
I clicked on it just because. I clicked on memories, and there's a memory of my friend who committed suicide.
Okay, so you see what I'm saying? Is it a good memory?
He was featured on 60 Minutes, and they did a piece about him, you know, about helping others. But then, you know, I see this piece about Brian, and I'm like, so I remember the good Brian did, but I also remember how difficult it was to lose him. So you see what I'm saying? Like,
it's bittersweet.
Bittersweet.
I'm pretty sure nostalgia is a Greek term to describe the pain of an old wound.
Oh,
that's okay. Yeah. That's what nostalgia is. So it's like sometimes you look at these things and you do feel a little twinge of pain.
You know, I don't feel so good right now. I have some pains.
Hey, good morning. Happy Tuesday. And here's what's coming up this hour. Do you wait too long when the check engine light comes on? What repairs do you leave to the last minute? We're talking about that at 7:45.
And there's a surprising connection between street gangs and the military. We talk with a former Army CID special agent about how crime and the military mix. That's at 7:30.
And our employees feeling quitter's remorse, the unintended consequences of the great resignation in just a few minutes. But first, despite being stuck inside, thanks to the pando, the birth rate is getting pretty low, with about half the states out there recording more deaths than births. So what's keeping young people from parenthood? And are your kids waiting longer? 312-591-8900. Are they delaying? Why? Is it you? Is it your children? Is it your grandchildren? Why aren't they having kids? The birth rate is declining, period. It just is.
Yeah, I don't even know if it's they're not waiting. They're just not having kids.
They've determined
it's too expensive. More women, you know, have careers. They want to work. It just, they think gets in the way, maybe. child care is so expensive.
You hear you can scare parents, would-be parents, pretty quickly with the numbers.
I mean, unless you have a really good job, well-paying job, it's not worth it. You know, to even hire a nanny or
but to get
daycare.
To that point, you maybe have to have some college. Right. You have to maybe work for a while.
Yeah.
So when you finally get to the point you can afford kids, maybe you're like, well, now it's too late to have kids.
Right.
Is that kind of what's going on?
In like my day, people who didn't have kids, and you know, there's a difference, of course, if you can't have kids, but the ones who chose not to have kids, it was like one couple out of 20. Yeah,
let's be honest, it was weird.
It wasn't weird. It was unusual. It was not what you did.
Well, and I think because of that, there was a pressure that you were supposed to have children.
Absolutely. And the ones who said, no, we're not having children, were like, oh,
what? The hell got into them?
Wait till your mom hears about that. Yes, I mean, it's just cult. We've changed, right? Times have changed. And I think a big part of this, too, that people are, they're worried about the world. The state of the world. They're worried about what the future holds.
Well, I can understand, certainly, the last couple of years, you might say, do I want to be pregnant during a pandemic? I could understand somebody going, I think we ought to hold off on that because, you know, who knows what that looks like? There was a lot of uncertainty going on, to say the least.
Yeah, do I want to have a baby?
And do I want to be in a hospital?
Exactly.
Around these times.
I mean, we just said half of all states saw more deaths than births, and that, you know, that was because of COVID.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know if this is going to change. You don't know which way it's going to go. And the thing is, America is kind of just now falling in line with Europe. I mean, that's how it is with the rest of the world.
It's been going that way otherwise.
Yeah, a lot of countries, they don't have a lot of kids like we do.
Yeah.
And by a lot, I mean three.
Yeah, we're not the Dugars or whatever.
The Duggars?
Duggars.
Mm-hmm. But how many is that, 12?
I have the foggiest idea. I don't want you.
Well, I mean, you know, my kids, I had three kids. They have 20-something cousins.
Wow.
Because their dad came from a family of 10. It was not unusual to have 10 kids.
Yeah. And I'm like on the opposite end. Well, obviously. I have no children I'm aware of. Let me just start with that. I think that's an important distinction.
So we'll put that at three.
No children that I'm aware of. But my brother has two.
Yeah. Two's.
And that's the family. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's us. You know, I mean, my mother had one brother.
Two's very usual.
Yes.
I mean, when you, like, I had three and people are like, ooh, three. I'm like, I wanted six. Yeah.
Wasn't the average 2.5 or something?
2 point something for a while.
I was like,
three-tenths of a kid?
You know what? And they were always the worst kid, too.
Be against the law.
What, the three-tenths kid?
Yeah.
Wow, geez.
It's horrific.
Let me tell my third brother. It's like, hey, you're the three-tenths kid.
Well, and I'll tell you the reason why I didn't have six kids, because I started late.
Oh.
Now it's not late. Back when I was doing it, it was, I'm 30. I mean, I had my last kid, almost 40.
Everyone else was having kids when they were 17.
Well, not my, yeah, exactly. Well, that's our parents' age. Yeah, that's.
Otherwise, you were an old maid, right?
A spinster.
Oh, my God.
You need a gentleman collar.
Yeah.
You know?
It's so funny. You're a spinster, or the man was a bachelor.
Mm, oh, yes.
Really?
Yeah,
I'm a spinster and you're a bachelor. Yeah, I think not. Not anymore, Bucky.
It is. It has gotten a little bit easier. Don't get me wrong. It has gotten easier for people like me, where I don't have to constantly explain why I don't have children, because I certainly had to go through that for quite some time.
Really?
You know? Absolutely.
Well, yeah, I guess so.
So you don't have any kids? What's okay? Why don't you have any? Okay, at least people stop kind of like they don't ask that anymore. It's. I mean,
I might call that a rude question. Even at this point.
Well, I was going to say, well, why do you have kids? I would say, and they would say, you know, you got a point. What's your life like? You want to switch play? Like, I remember my one friend goes, let me get this straight. And he told me this recently. He's got two daughters, and he said, you could go anywhere you wanted this weekend and you don't even have to ask anybody's permission or coordinate around soccer games. What's that like? Tell me what that's like.
The sweet taste of freedom.
Yeah. I go, you know, I was the odd one for quite some time. And then, you know, all of a sudden all my guy friends were living vicariously through me, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I say this, you know, I do want children.
Okay.
I plan on having children.
I don't have any that you know of?
Yeah, not. I don't think so. There may have been, I didn't make any
something
donations.
Something you might want to bring up before the wedding, but go ahead.
Yes. But I understand the want to wait because, you know, my fiance, she doesn't have her full on job yet. She's got, you know, work, but she wants to feel that security.
Established.
She wants to feel established like our parents did, but I don't know if we can get there as quickly. I don't know if the conditions are the same for
So what are you saying? It's gonna it might be longer, you might be older having kids?
I've had to literally sit her down and be like, I don't wanna wait till I'm 35. Not saying that there's anything wrong with that, but I'm like, I'd rather not wait. My dad was an old dad. He didn't have me until he was like almost 40.
Yeah.
And I understand that that happens sometimes, and people have their own reasons, and it's cool. We live in a wonderful new world.
Remember, 60 is the new 60 is the new 40. Are you kidding? Parents are, believe me, the kids will wear you out and make you old, but you can wait for Nick. I don't think 50 or 40 year old parents are old anymore. They're not.
Hey, Jay in Michigan, when did you get married?
Listen, you guys are going to totally love this. I waited till I was 35, Tom.
35. Got married 35.
I still get carded. I still get carded occasionally for alcohol.
Can't get into an R-rated movie, Jay. Okay, cool.
I still look like a young man, and I was able to squeeze in four kids under four by 40.
In five years, you've got four kids in?
Bruce, I forgot about twins.
There were twins in there. Okay. They didn't tell you about twins, did they?
Yeah.
Congratulations, by the way.
So wait, you're 40? You're 40? Do you feel 60?
You know what? I take the stairs all the time. I feel like I'm 18, and I'm about as mature as I'm 16. So
there you go.
Nowhere near it. Nowhere near it. And I appreciate what you guys are doing every morning. But honestly, I think waiting, you're more relaxed.
Oh?
I'm a little like, if at 25 I had children, the maturity, 25-year-old Jay compared to 35-year-old Jay. Much better.
A world different.
Yeah.
Well, we're appreciative of 40-year-old Jay as well right now. Yeah. So, Jay, thank you very much. Yeah. So he waited until he was 35, and now 5 years later, he's got four kids.
And there is something about kids keeping you younger.
But also, I think he's, you know, there's a maturity level. He handles it better at this
age
than he would have at 25 when he still
wanted to
be in the bars out there. Yeah, without a doubt. Hey, and a quick reminder, WLS is presenting the No Spin Zone with Bill O'Reilly, a live speaking event this Thursday night at the Genesee Theater in Waukegan. Doors at 6, show starts at 7. You can see the No Spin Zone live with Bill O'Reilly. As a matter of fact, we'll be giving away some tickets a little bit later. If you can't wait, well, just go to WLSAM.com. You can find out how you can buy your tickets and all the information you need for Thursday night's Bill O'Reilly No Spin Zone Live. So one of the things we've heard about, the term I heard is called the Great Resignation, where all of these people, during the pando, for a variety of different reasons, quit their jobs. Take this job and shove. They went straight Antonio Brown. They ripped off the jersey and ran off the field, right? But now we're finding, well, maybe some of them were a little hasty.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they were overly optimistic. What is behind maybe some of this quitter's remorse? Joining us right now is Julie Bokey, president and chief career strategist at the Bokey Group. Julie, good morning.
Good morning.
So do tell me, why are some of these people regretting it? Did they just not maybe plan for the future very well?
Yeah, there's a lot of factors there. And let me first say that I've been in this world for about 20 plus years. And mm-hmm. so I'm not surprised.
Oh.
First of all, yeah, not at all. First of all, just a very tactical reason. During the pandemic, or the pando, as you call it, you know, people couldn't do live interviews. And mm-hmm. so they were restricted to doing interviews over Zoom.
Okay.
And that, you lose a lot in translation when all you're doing is a video interview. What is the, you know, how do you, what kind of, what's your gut feel? What's the office environment like? You know, you don't get to probably talk to as many people as you were. So people's decision-making abilities were somewhat limited, number one. Number two, in any situation, whether it's during a recession or, you know, during a time when the demand outstrips the supply, no matter what, human beings often make decisions, especially around job search. They jump before they're ready. They jump before they've thought about why and what and where. All they know is they've heard that, or they get a call that says you can get a 20% increase. And I think that's really like catnip.
it's a shiny, dangly thing, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I'm going to get a 20% raise. But in my experience, a lot of times, if you are in a job that you don't want to be in anymore, money's not the reason that you're unhappy. It's, you know, 10 other things. Money can be one of them. So you have to really think about, why do I want to change jobs? And what we always ask our clients first is, can you fix your issues where you are? In other words, try to, you know, the grass isn't always greener. What's that thing about, you know, you got to water the grass you're on. And so take a look at, before you change jobs, the first question ought to be, why am I changing? What do I hope to get more of? What do I want to change? And then, can I get it right where I am with having the right conversations with my boss? And then and only then should you think about changing.
Now, Julie, what about the part where about 72% of people say that they were surprised to learn that their new roles were different than what they were led to believe? You know, what about the other side of the coin there when companies lure you in and then it turns out, oh, this is not the job I thought
it was. The grass isn't greener?
Yep. No, it's brown and dead.
Uh-huh, exactly. So you're right. The employers are desperate in many cases to fill roles. And so they perfume the pig. They're like, we got all kinds of opportunity. Yeah, we have flexibility. Yeah, you can do this. Yeah. And then you get there and discover there was just this total miss in what you wanted, what you were led to believe was there, what you hoped for, and what the employer was actually selling/offering. And so there's this pressure on the employer side to get bodies into seats. And that has led to all kinds of problems. This being just one of them, a total mismatch of what you're looking for, what you hope to find, and what the person wants. And here's one of the differences today than, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, is that Gen Z and millennials, they're not afraid to go, all righty, well, that was a mess, and move on to something else. And in a market like we're in, so to baby boomers, that's like, what? You've got to stay a year or two.
Yeah, you know, just to save face.
Anymore. Yeah, but that's actually not true anymore, especially when you're sitting in a job market like this.
Yeah.
There's another employer hot to hire you out there who's going to overlook the fact that you made a mistake. The problem, here's where it starts to get really tricky. If you've got three or four of those in a row,
mistakes.
You know, I don't care, right? All of a sudden, you're a person who makes bad decisions.
Yeah. Yeah. Do be careful what you wish for. Julie Bauke.
Exactly.
Again, the president and chief career strategist at the Bauke Group. As we find out that just about 72% of people who quit, who left their jobs, who walked away, now regret doing so. Do we have any information on those that are trying to come back? And would you even suggest trying to go back to the old gig?
You know, I saw a stat years ago, and I haven't seen a stat like it recently, but I believe that it still is, I believe that it's still solid. It's something like 92% of people who either accept a counteroffer to stay where they are after being given an offer someplace else, or decide to come back after a quote-unquote, you know, failed attempt, end up leaving again in the next year.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. In fact, I just talked to somebody the other day who's in that situation. She went to a new employer, and because of COVID, some of the things they wanted to do and she wanted to do haven't been possible yet. So at a weak moment, she got contacted by her last employer who called her and said, hey, the door's always open. She was trying to decide what to do. So as we talked through it, I said, what caused you to leave? Think back. What caused you to leave employer A when you did? Well, this, and this. Have those things changed? Well, not really. So then why would you go back? You know, she said, well, they're making noise about changing those things. I said, okay, no. I am almost positive that if you went back to company A, you'd go, dang it. You know, what did I just do?
Right.
And you'd regret going back. And so you've got to stay crystal clear on what your reasons were for going, for staying, and what they would be for coming back. And ask yourself, you know, is this really what I want? And I think we lead with our emotions sometimes when it comes to this kind of stuff, and which is going to lead us, unless we're really thinking some sort of logic on top of it, and with real clarity about what we want and what's most important to us in our career, then I think we're destined to keep making those mistakes because we haven't really gotten clear on what's driving us either forward or to stay where we are.
Julie, really appreciate your time this morning. Thank you so much. Hey, good morning to you. Happy Tuesday, Bruce and Judy with you. And I got to take you back just over a year ago where, you know, unsurprisingly and flying under the radar like they normally do, there was a gang shooting, gang-involved shooting that led to the deaths of some gang members. We hear that almost a daily basis here in Chicago. Now, as we learn later on, through a series of other shootings and deaths, the guns were traced to some straw buyers. Straw buyer is a person who goes in, says they're buying the gun for themselves, not really, and then turns around and sells it. A way somebody can get around, a background check, if you will. So the guns used in these crimes were provided by three members of the military. Okay, I did not know that was a thing necessarily. The three soldiers based at Fort Campbell, which is right on the Kentucky-Tennessee border, are now accused of several federal gun crimes. But it made me think, okay, so there's got to be more to this story. We learn that at least one of the soldiers has what's being described as ties, community ties, to street gangs in Chicago. It's not hard to believe that maybe they were a member of the gang, gang-related, family members, and in the military. So how prevalent are gangs and military? Like, is that really a thing? It's a thing, and we're talking to a guy that knows all about it right now, Dr. Carter F. Smith, professor at Middle Tennessee State University. You are the expert on gangs in the military, Professor. Thank you for joining us.
I'm so glad to be here, Bruce. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I'm going to guess the story I just told of some soldiers buying guns and then providing them to a street gang in Chicago, while we hear it and we think it's shocking, maybe it's more common than we think?
Maybe not more common, but it's not the first time. And I will say, it just to put it into perspective, mm-hmm. members of street gangs and members of the military are members of our communities, either before or after. So the percentage of people who commit these kinds of goofy, silly, whatever, I'll explain why I say that, crimes, are no different, really, than the folks we live next to.
Mm.
The reason I say that is because my two youngest sons learned their work ethic from working at a grocery store. And when they became cashiers, they were dumbfounded at how many of their coworkers thought it was brilliant to bring in a friend and scan coupons to their heart's desire and then pocket the money. And then they'd get busted and they'd be surprised because, wow, I'm the genius that came up with this idea. How could they ever have caught me doing this? You know what I mean? And so, right. Yeah, so we've got a bunch of young guys who join the military and try to get out of the gang. To be fair, most of them try to get out of the gang when they join the military, and the vast majority appear to succeed. Either that or they get really smart and are able to conceal their criminality. Mm-hmm. But I'll let you decide that. But then they get past basic training in AIT where they don't do a brainwash, where they don't change their values, where they don't teach them right from wrong. They just teach them how to shoot, move, and communicate in the military. And then they send them to a unit where they really, unless they're in a war zone, not at war, in a war zone, they have a full-time job, the equivalent of what you and I do for a living, that amount of time, and the rest of it is free time. And they'll hang around with other people who may or may not be like-minded, who may or may not have had gang experience in the background or in their background, and they come up with these great ideas now that they have access to the whole world and wow. Kentucky guns and things of that nature.
So do gang members join the military for specific purposes, like to learn how to shoot a gun, to meet other like-minded people? You know, I mean, is that a pathway to something more sinister?
That's a great question, let me back up just briefly, Judy. I will tell you that I happened to cross gangs, and I know Chicago's had gangs longer than anybody, at least 150 years that I can recall. I used to attend the gang conference up there annually and studied Thrasher and the folks that know way more about gangs in Chicago than I. But we just discovered them in our part just north of Nashville, Tennessee, in the 90s, the very early 90s. We happened across some folks that were committing crime in the name of their gang. And so I called cops in L.A. and cops in Chicago and cops in Miami and Houston. And I started asking all these questions because the military is a microcosm of society. We send our young people all over the country to the military, not all of them, but a percentage of them. And they, whether they've got a gang background or a delinquent background or something, they're taking their past with them, and so we had to learn about that and get really smart on it early in the 90s. Well, we figured out that, yes, some of them are joining specifically to get a training in something or another. It's not just soldiering, though. It's not just shooting a gun or blowing up tanks with a landmine or dismantling an improvised explosive device. It's also recruiting. It's also finance managing.
Wow.
People managing. I mean, think of any job in the corporate world. The military's got a flavor of a portion of that, and gangs need a portion of that. There was a, do you remember back? Oh, I want to say in at least 15 years ago, Sudhir Venkatesh wrote a couple books on his experience with the gangs. He came out of Freakonomics. There was a chapter in the book, Freakonomics, yes. Why Crack Dealers Still Live With Their Mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And I got interested in that whole economist perspective of gang activity and criminal activity. And then Sudhir Venkatesh, wrote a book called Gang Leader for a Day. And that book was the most enlightening. If you've never read it, at least take a look at it, because it gets you inside the mind of a gang member. There was the leader of the gang. I wish I could remember his name. He had a business degree from some university and realized that when he got into the business world, he hit a ceiling. It was not the glass ceiling we've heard of, but he hit a ceiling, and he wasn't making the kind of money he was back on the streets in the hood. And he said, you know, I think either he quoted him or either this is his quote or it's my paraphrase because I've used this before. He said the guy had a revelation that all he had to do was duck a couple bullets and periodically bury a couple homies, and he could make multiple times what he was making with his business degree. And he ran the gang like a business. What a concept.
Yeah, we're talking to Dr. Carter F. Smith, a professor at Middle Tennessee State University, an expert on gangs, street gangs, and gangs in the military. I wanted to ask you a follow-up question, though.
Yes,
is how is the military dealing with this? Is the military aware that there is an issue, left to be seen how big, of gangs, gang members, gang activity tied to the military? How are they dealing with it, or are they?
They're dealing with it, air quotes. but I will tell you that they have heard that there are gang members in the military. They have heard that gang members come in the military for a variety of reasons, and that just being in basic training doesn't fix them. And they've heard on a regular basis that the biggest problem, in my opinion, is that it's what you do with the military gang members once you've trained them and they've done their time in the military. And they send them out in the community because there's way more veterans than there are current active duty members.
Good point.
Gang members and otherwise. So there's not a whole lot that they do in the military because most of the military leaders, honestly, are focused on military leadership. And the gang members are just a liability, but not a big one. Mm. And their numbers are relatively small. And these guys are smart enough to not get caught being a gang member while they're in the military. And they're learning how to conceal that even better, which exacerbates the problem when they get out.
Wow.
So, yeah. So the only way they could do a good job of it is to notify the police at the location where that gang member is getting out if they never prosecute him or identified him. And quite frankly, there isn't enough time in the day to do that.
Yeah, so, that mechanism doesn't exist.
Right, and I've actually asked cops on surveys, does that exist? And it's they're torn. It doesn't, but there's not enough time in the day for the military to devote the man hours to actually make those phone calls, if they ever identified them as a gang member in the first place.
Professor, thank you so much for your time. Very enlightening. I love it when we learn. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And I've got homework. I got to read Gang Leader for a
day. Yeah.
I got some homework from Dr. Carter F. Smith, professor at Middle Tennessee State University, about gangs in the military, and that while some people might be shocked to find that guns purchased by active duty military ended up in the hands of gang members here in Chicago and were used in a series of murders, maybe we shouldn't be that shocked by it. And that the military is a microcosm of what regular society looks like. So whatever percentage you think of gang members in society, you should probably expect something similar inside the military. And a good morning, a happy Tuesday. Bruce and Judy with you. Technology can be your friend. It also can be your nemesis. What is the oldest piece of technology that you still have around? Well, use.
If we were having a contest, one of our listeners, a texter, would win. 314. They still have.
I'm ready.
Open reel recorder. That's the reel to reel.
The reel to reel, the magnetic tape on the big. Yeah, okay.
A record player.
All right.
A tube radio. I forgot I have one of those.
Okay.
A black and white TV.
What?
A transistor radio. Dial phone, cassette recorder, this is the best. These last two are the best. Wall calendar. Who still has a calendar?
I have a wall calendar.
Yeah.
You know what? I like calendars. And this is my favorite, index card file.
Yeah. It's like they're Amish.
I love
it. You're just one step away from Amish.
I love index cards.
Unreal.
I found a whole stack from the kids, obviously their school supply, 10 years or so ago. Because, you know, you buy stuff and you just buy too much of it all the time. I've been using them ever since. I love writing little notes on those cards.
You know, it's funny because a friend of mine, she was a BlackBerry fan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
lots of people.
And for a while, it became you couldn't get them. So, like, they found one in Europe. You know, like money's no object. We got to find some used BlackBerry. Have it sent over. And I mean, eventually it just stopped working. You know what I'm saying? Like, this just doesn't work anymore. But she was the last person with a BlackBerry. Like, I'm going to go down swinging. If it's the last thing I ever do, I'm holding on to my BlackBerry.
That's the problem, right?
Right. You know the other problem? Your car. A lot of technology goes into cars. But how in tune are you with your car? It turns out, with a survey from people that do surveys, that a majority of us don't notice a problem with our car before the passengers do. When your friends get in the car, they notice something. Is that just kind of where you get used to it? Like that sound?
Oh, yeah.
Or that...
You notice it.
That bump.
You ignore it.
You ignore it. You're ignoring it.
Like, seriously, and you forget about it.
Yeah.
Right? You just, God, that light's still on. Just not going to look at it anymore. I'm going to cover it up with a piece of tape.
Yeah, there's like two types of people in the world.
I'm not either.
I got to get it fixed immediately.
Well, and the problem is, speaking of old, if you have an older car, you don't get all those warnings.
Oh, the little idiot lights.
I have a 2006. There's no, there are no lights. I have to remember when I changed my oil or when I last filled up the tires, that sort of thing. But yeah, I get it. People have probably told me that too. Something like, oh, you know, your tire's low or sound there.
Every time I get in my mom's car, every time I go visit mom, and I drive mom. No one will get in the car with mom as a driver. I'm like, mom. How long has it been doing this? Doing what?
Pulling to the right, up on the sidewalk.
She had one thing where when you accelerate, I'm getting on the freeway, and it goes like, ka-chunk, you know, the transmission. And I went, the hell was that? She goes, yeah, it does that. No, it's not supposed to do that, Mom. No, ixnay. That's a bad thing.
That's the last part of you know it, you ignore it, you don't get it fixed, and you go, wait, it's supposed to be like that.
Isn't it supposed to be like that?
Yeah, it's always been like that, as long as I can remember.
Who ever made that horrific noise, right? Or the lights on the dashboard. Mom, do you see this? Yeah. What does that mean? It means your tire is going down. It's you have low air pressure in your right front tire. Oh, I didn't know that's what it meant. Swear to God.
Now, I will say I haven't been driving my other car because my son's back in town. And I just drove it the other day, and I did notice, like, the steering was hard to turn.
Okay. could be steering fluid.
I mentioned it, and he's like, "Yeah, it's been like that. It's always like that." I said, "I don't think it is always like that." But then, of course, I haven't driven it in a while, and same thing.
Okay.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm used to my other car that it is turns a lot, you know, easier, and so things like that where you just go, and then I just, you know, what I did, I brought it, Bruce. Nothing.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. You're consistent.
I just brought it up now, and it's been 2 weeks. I'm like, oh, I should probably get back to that issue.
Yeah. Here's the thing you learn about cars specifically. Any sort of really good mechanical, complex mechanical device, they rarely fix themselves. Rarely, if ever.
I feel like you left an opening there. Sometimes they do.
Rarely.
Sometimes the tire does fill itself
back up with air. Yeah. Sometimes the engine oil suddenly replenishes itself. Sometimes that
the
knocking
filters
sound.
Get changed.
Yeah. Well, my last race at the end of last year, we had a bit of a knocking sound in the engine, and it fixed itself when the rod went through the side of the block. But that was a great example to me going, yeah, they never fixed themselves.
Yeah.
In a positive
way,
to say
the
least.
Might want to take care of that car.
Yeah. Just don't wait for your friends to get in the car and go, why the hell are you doing that? All right. And a good morning, 8 o'clock hour. Taking a look at what's coming up. How about this? A medical miracle allows a paralyzed man to ask for something he's wanted for a long time. A beer. We've got the story coming up at 8:45.
And you don't have to head downtown to enjoy Chicago Restaurant Week. Let's go to Wilmette for some high-quality eats. That's at 8:30.
And two moderators at the popular social networking company TikTok are suing for being forced to watch hours of disturbing content. Did they not understand the job description? Coming up in just a few minutes. But first, a list of America's best cities for pizzas ruffled a few feathers by placing Chicago and New York way too low on the list. Pulitzer Prize winning author Mark Conkle, journalist, isn't taking it lightly. Joining us now is Mark Conkle of Patch.com. And Mark, before I jump into you, a reminder that your $25,000 payday national keyword was pay. Text word pay to 95819 if you missed it. All right. So, Mark, you saw this list of the greatest pizza cities. They took into account the cities. And like me, I'm sure, were shocked. Shocked, I tell you. To find out how low Chicago was on the list.
Yes. And I was also shocked that, like, you know, the story or the study, alleged study, showed up everywhere. So I took a look at, you know, how they made this decision. And, I think one of the things that's interesting about news these days, and I don't know if you've picked up on it, is that the best of list is kind of, you know, something that pops up all the time.
Yeah.
But it's not, it's not really, you know, we're not having like a major outlet, you know, with doing them. This time it was anytimeestimate.com, you know, those big statistical minds there.
It's like BuzzFeed does that all the time, right? The top 10 include whatever it is here. Yeah.
Well, Mark, it sounds like your undercover investigation has proven that this is a fraud.
I mean, I know it's a fraud when we're talking about pizza. I mean, you could check my waistline on that.
You're an expert.
I'm an expert.
Yeah.
And, you know, anytimeestimate.com, you know, they have this statistical computation of demographics, Google Trends, pizza prices, cheese pizza prices. Who eats cheese pizza? Except for vegetarians, of course. But, you know, not in Chicago. And then, you know, places like Pizza Today. And, that's how Detroit ranked number one pizza city in America, according to this, you know, calculation. And Cleveland and Columbus, Ohio, were number two and three.
It's an abomination, Mark.
Huh?
It's an abomination, Mark.
It really is. I mean, you know, and they ranked Chicago number three for deep dish pizza cities behind North Carolina. Two cities in North Carolina.
But you know what? There are those critics, Mark, who will say that, you know, get over it, Chicago. You're only known outside Chicago for your deep dish pizza. Do you buy that?
You know, like, I appreciate that, but I eat all the pizzas in Chicago. the thin crusts are my regular. You know, when someone comes to town, I take them to Pequot's because that's what you're supposed to do.
Right.
You know, but when you Google North Carolina deep dish pizza scenes in Charlotte, the first place that comes up on Yelp is Mass Chicago. How could they rank higher than us as a pizza deep dish pizza city when the best pizza place is a Chicago pizza place? I just don't get it.
And I think people don't realize you can only eat deep dish pizza once in a while. You can't eat it all the time. It's too much. You got to go to the thin crust.
Right.
So, you know, we can't just be known for that.
No. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, Doreen's and Hegwisch, I'm sure you've never tried it, but they actually deliver to my neighborhood, so they're my number one pizza place. And, you know, perfect crust.
Right.
You get it well done so it's a little crispy. You can't get that. You can't get that in Cleveland.
Apparently like, you can, and, but...
Have you ever had a pizza in Tampa?
Okay, no. Yeah, that's just
no one went to Tampa for the pizza. He's Mark Conkle, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Fetch.com. Getting to the bottom, by the way, of this horrific list of the best pizza cities in America. It strikes me, though, Mark, in reading your piece again, which is latest best city clickbait has ingredients for worst pizza list. You can read it at Fetch.com. You have a special, there's a specific thorn in your side for the city of Detroit.
Actually, I like Detroit. I mean, because it's what Chicago could turn into, you know, at any moment. You know, going through bankrupt, they've got a casino in town in Detroit. They went bankrupt. They're very corrupt. Their mayor went to jail.
They all go to jail at some point.
I mean, I'm not criticizing Detroit.
Yeah.
It's their pizza. It's literally garlic bread with stuff on top.
Dressed up garlic bread is all it is.
That's all that it really is. Oh. I mean, you know, they put it in a square pan to be different, but you know, I didn't put it in the column, but I looked it up. It's like deep dish pizza in Chicago was invented 4 years before someone in Detroit created a thick square pizza. I mean, come on.
What are you saying? They copied us?
We know where that comes from.
Yeah. They stole our pizza and put it in a square pan.
Once everyone, you know, was able to travel at ease, they're like, oh, we need to have this Chicago pizza. And, you know, apparently it's done well for Detroit and Cleveland and Charlotte, North Carolina.
And Tampa.
Right.
Mark, far be it from you. Far be it from you to come to the defense of New York City, but you even made a point like, come on, dudes. I mean, we may not like New York, but you got to give them some credit for the pizza, right?
Right. I mean, and, you know, let's think about how many people are in New York City. How are they going to, like, who's the genius at anytimeestimate.com that decided, like, pizza population density matters in New York? You can buy a 24-hour slice of pizza in New York for $1 pretty much every three steps in Manhattan.
You do have a point. Yeah, you cannot throw a rock without hitting a pizza place in New York. That goes without saying. Yeah. Hey, Mark, appreciate your time this morning. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark.
Hey, thanks, Bruce and Judy. Appreciate it.
Go enjoy a slice.
I don't think you need to invite him twice. Yeah. Mark Conkle, again, you can read his piece at Patch.com. The latest best city clickbait has ingredients for the worst pizza list. And he does make a good point that anytimeestimate.com, who came up with this list, is not exactly known as a world-class polling outfit. Right. That might be a nice way to put it. So
obviously hired by Tampa, Cleveland. South Detroit. Carolina. Detroit. I mean, I like the square pizza. I do. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, Chicago does it too. We do square pizza.
Hey, how do you get your $8.90 each day? You can make it real easy and listen on your smart speaker. All you have to do is enable the skill. You can say, Alexa, enable the WLS skill, or just visit the skills section of your Alexa smartphone app and search for WLS AM 890. Either way, after you've enabled the skill, it's easy to listen just by saying, Alexa, open WLS. All right, here you go. So, TikTok is just the latest, and maybe, you know, these things come in
come in waves. The latest app, social media channel that is all the rage out there. You know, you go from Facebook to Instagram to TikTok. I skipped a few Snapchats in there or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But something you may or may not be aware of is that there are employees of these companies whose sole job is to watch, basically moderate every video that is posted and scan for and or get rid of ones with objectionable content. I mean, that was one of the big issues, remember, Facebook had for a long time. They're letting these videos on that show all this horrible stuff. Instagram has all these, you know, images and videos. So, you know, they do have algorithms. They do have computers that can do it.
Yeah, I was like, why don't they just have a machine do it? Why do they even need people?
You still need people, apparently, sometimes to find the truly objectionable in a video. It's something that violates their terms of service. But now we have some TikTok employees, former, who are suing. And they're telling us a little bit about, well, kind of what was in those videos.
Yeah, it's just graphic, objectionable. I mean, I hate to even use their words. Just necrophilia,
the worst
children
things you
being
can think
killed.
Of.
I mean, terrible. Violence against children, distressing imagery. Now, and the thing is, if you have, it seems to me that it would be, the machine would be the one to catch the really glaring ones, and then you have the people to maybe get the ones that are on the fence. Mm. But these, as they're called, content moderators, say that they were forced 12 hours a day to watch this nonstop. And if you recall, the Facebook moderators who sued and won, they said they had developed PTSD.
From looking at some of these videos that were horrific
cases. If you're seeing children being raped and killed, shot in the face, bestiality, necrophilia, over and over and over for 12 hours a day, every day, I got to think that does take a toll. Because I know people will say, well, you signed up for the job.
There are billions of users of TikTok.
Billions.
Posting videos. There are 10,000 of these content moderators who, like you said, 12 hours a day, they sit in front of a screen, basically,
And look at distressing images.
Horrible, like the worst things, like the what is it, like the dark net, you know, the things they don't let on the regular internet because people are trying to post these things all the time.
In the last 6 months, 81 million plus videos were removed.
Wow.
What is wrong with people?
Yeah, they'll needless to say, post anything on there. So what is the way around it, though? What is the way around it?
Like I said, technology, machines. I don't know why a machine can do everything. Why can't it do this?
I don't know are we at the point now where a machine can watch a video and determine if it's objectionable?
I think so. If you put the parameters in, right, if you tell it what is objectionable, that's what I'm saying. The stuff that maybe can squeak through the cracks, then you have your live, real human being sitting there and making a judgment call on that one. But these look to me like, no one's going to make it. No one's going to have any issue saying, do you think this child being killed, is it acceptable or unacceptable? I mean, I don't know.
I just don't know where the state of technology is to the point that things wouldn't fall through the cracks. And we'd be here having a different story about, oh, my God, can you see all the videos that TikTok's letting get through? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, or no videos get through, which I don't think would be too bad.
Somebody has to make the call. Somebody has to do it. But I can certainly understand, these employees saying basically suffering from PTSD from having to watch the worst videos on the internet for 12 hours a day. And we're not talking about the silly dance videos. We're literally talking about crimes being committed.
People doing stupid things.
Terrorism.
You know? Yeah. Well, and I think their bigger issue here is, and they obviously didn't really know what they were signing up for, but okay, if that's the job, that they're saying that TikTok, there's no recourse. There's nothing to help them deal with that.
Okay.
If they're going to have to do it for 12 hours a day because they insist that they watch as much content as possible, because there is so much content,
then
they're
going to,
you got to have something for the employees after a 12-hour shift like that. It's not like you can just go home and take a bath and feel better.
Yeah, it's different from a lot of other jobs that you would expect like that. I saw a video once of kind of how they do this, and it had like, you've seen like the telephone bank, you know, before, like a call center. Mm-hmm. And it had like these cubicles. And there were a bunch of, this one was a bunch of ladies sitting in front of a computer screen. And they just had like a button, yes or no, red or green. You know what I'm saying? And the images would pop up. They go, yep, nope, yep, yep, nope. And they, I mean, and they were making decisions like that quick. If something was objectionable, something was pornographic, something was violent. But keep in mind, that's what they are literally doing, is looking at all these, nope, nope, oh my God, no, 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 you know, that they're being
they could tell within the first
pretty
few
quickly
seconds,
you
though,
can
which
tell
is good. Yeah, well, yeah, well, if, I mean, they say let's see, child sexual abuse, rape, torture, bestiality, beheadings, suicide, and murder. Those are probably really quick to identify.
You would hope, right? You would certainly hope. So what is the solution? Can technology save these people from having to watch all these horrific videos? And by the way, this is just TikTok.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, there's a similar group of people doing this at Facebook. Similar group of people doing this at Instagram. Similar group of people doing this at every other app that allows for images and or videos, because there are people out there that are trying to post just the worst things you can even
think about. All I can say is
about.
Thank you. That's what you should be thanking these people. Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah. Something's got to be done.
Hey, good morning to you. A happy Tuesday. Bruce and Judy with you. And we know that it is Chicago Restaurant Week, but Restaurant Week in Chicago isn't limited to just Chicago. There are some amazing places if you get outside of the city, which brings us to
Getting Foodie with Bruce and Judy.
And joining us right now is Chef Michael Lakowitz with Aboye. How did I do on the pronunciation?
Aboye. Nailed it. I'm very impressed, my friend. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. It is French. What does it mean in French?
Aboye means to bark. And if you knew me, you would know this is a perfect moniker for my restaurant, because I can't shut up.
Well, you have certainly got a tale to sing. And first off, we talk about it being Chicago Restaurant Week, but, you know, you guys are in Winnetka. Heck, you don't have to be in Chicago to find a world-class restaurant.
No, there's no question. I've been in the suburbs. I started in Glen Ellen. I've been in the suburbs for 30 years, and generally speaking, I need to aboye a lot, because otherwise we get disregarded. But I'm easy to find because I never shut up, like I said. So yeah. I got to blow my own horn. And we have been blessed with lots of press and recognition. And Winnetka specifically has been great for us. I've been here for 17 years now, and it's been great. I have a wonderful community surrounding me, and they're incredibly supportive on the North Shore. That's fantastic.
True. You know, Chef Michael, you don't sound French.
I mean, there's nothing French about me except the food. Lakowitz? I'm not even sure what that mix is. I'm a mutt.
Oh, that's so funny. Well, tell us how you got interested in French food, because, I mean, that's where your expertise lies.
I started cooking when I was I grew up in the apartment above my grandpa's restaurant. So when I was 4 years old, 5 years old, I was peeling potatoes. So I was always around it, and I was always fascinated by it, and I knew I wanted to cook, and it caught me very young. And I ended up in New York at the Culinary Institute as soon as I graduated high school, and I didn't know I wanted to cook French, but I was kind of adopted by one of my early instructors, and he said, "You want to come and work on the weekend? I got some stuff on the side here on Sunday." I said, "Yeah, what is it, a brunch?" He goes, "No, it's a nice restaurant." I was like, "Oh, well, pardon me, little crazy Irish chef guy."
It's a nice place.
Turns out he was a chef. He was a chef at Maxine's before he became an instructor at the culinary. And I walked in the door, and that was it. I was hooked. It was amazing. I to this day, when I walked up the back stairs, and they were smoking salmon in this little stainless steel smoker. To this day, while we smoke salmon outside behind the restaurant, it takes me back to when I was 18 years old walking up those back stairs. It's amazing. The olfactory senses trigger memories for me. So I always knew I wanted to do French from that day forward, and that's all I've ever done. From Le Francais to Café Provençal, I did some time in France and Lyon, and I was very fortunate to be taken in by some real titans. You know, I'm kind of – the running joke is I'm too old to be young and too young to be old. I'm kind of one of the last of the Mohicans. You know, we still do major sauce work in Winnetka, and it's not as easy to find as it once was. So we like to wave that flag. I got a great team of people been with me for the entire time I've been in Winnetka, for some, in spite of me, some of that time. But I got a hell of a group. I mean, I'm very blessed and very fortunate. A couple of them I made partners.
All right, Chef, let's talk a little bit about the food at Aboye. You talk about it, you kind of an American French, and by the way, just looking at the menu, your plating, I mean, it looks amazing. It looks delectable. Tell me about some of the real popular dishes, especially heading into Restaurant Week.
Well, a couple of the most popular dishes are on the Restaurant Week menu. I mean, we're doing the steak frites, of course, is always a mover. I mean, this is a hanger steak marinated with chimichurri over hand-cut fries with a chimichurri béarnaise sauce. It's really beautiful. And hanger steak is a great cut for this because it just has more flavor than a filet mignon. Or I just the more you have to chew, you know, the more you're going to develop flavor. You know, as you're chewing it, it kind of cascades over your palate, and it's just lovely. And the juices from the meat mixed with the fries, it's just great. That's why it's classic. You know, and then I have a pasta dish on there, a pappardelle. We hand roll the pasta at the restaurant, and it's mixed with this beautiful lamb juice with shredded lamb confit and duck confit and garlic sausage. And it's just really a hearty dish. It's beautiful. Since we're going up and down with weather all week long, it still seems to apply.
Yeah.
I got a grilled salmon with fresh morel mushrooms for the Restaurant Week menu, and we're doing a panna cotta and fruit soup and a pavé of chocolate with citrus. And it's just a really nice menu for $55 for three courses. It's a steal. It really is. And there's 350 restaurants plus, I believe, participating this year in Restaurant Week. It started on Friday, the 25th. It goes all the way through the 10th, so I think it's like 17 days straight. And it's a huge boost for the restaurant industry in general, but for the community in Chicago. You know, we were hit just as hard as anybody else. I don't know that we were hit harder than any other industry, but this is a great way for us to be able to come back. And it's a weird time of year, so it hits perfectly because up here, especially in the North Shore, it's, you know, Easter, Passover, tax season, spring breaks. It's a perfect storm.
Wow.
You know, and as it turns out, wealthy people do not care for tax season so much. who knew? Because I'm not a wealthy person. But it's really, it really hits at the right time, and it gives us a terrific boost in a time we'd normally have a flat spot. So it's worked out beautifully. It's the 15th year they've been doing it. And for Chicago to allow suburban restaurants to be part of it is, you know, it's a gift, and I'll take it. I'm not proud.
And it sounds like just a great time for people to drown their sorrows in some of your absolutely divine sauce. Because
it's huge, yeah.
Right?
People love the sauce work. They really do. It's because it's not as prominent on menus anymore.
Right. And I just feel like in Restaurant Week, it's a $55, you said, three-course meal. It's a time for people who wouldn't maybe necessarily think about going to a French restaurant to try it.
That's right. I mean, I only have 70 seats inside. Now, I could double that when I open the patio, but 70 seats inside. We did 120 people on Saturday. 90 people had the Restaurant Week menu.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah, people.
Awesome.
That's perfect. Absolutely.
Well, seek it out, but we convert them at the table, too. We want them to have that menu. That's the idea behind Restaurant Week for us is it's a huge marketing tool for us. I found a lot of customers over the last 7 years that we've participated that come back a dozen times over the year, you know, without Restaurant Week being in play. So we put our best foot forward because it doesn't make any sense to do a menu that doesn't represent the restaurant properly. It's got to be on brand.
Yeah. We're talking again to Chef Michael Lakowitz with Aboye in Winnetka. And again, participating in Chicago Restaurant Week, even restaurants outside of Chicago. So we specifically wanted to speak to somebody that was maybe a little bit more in the suburbs and get your vibe on it. What are some of the challenges, though, that you've had being a, you know, classy place? You know what I'm saying? In the suburbs, has there been more of a challenge for you?
Yeah, back in the day, 30 years ago, even 25 years ago, 20 years ago, there was a plethora of high-end restaurants all over the North Shore and in the suburbs in general. My first restaurant was in Glen Ellen, Le Du Gros, and that was in 99. Those restaurants have all disappeared, you know, right? Le Francais and Le Titi de Paris and Le Vichy Swan, even Gabrielle's and Carlos, they're all gone. But we've been here for 17 years, and now we're starting to see more restaurants pop up around us, right? The Ballyhoo Group has opened up Sophia Steakhouse, and they have Pomeroy. They opened up in Winnetka, and we have more restaurants that are popping all around us, and we need that. there is such a thing as critical mass, and we need more restaurants to pop up in the suburbs because it keeps people in the area.
Right, right. Rising tides raise all ships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. If you have to leave and go to Chicago to find a fine meal, then we're not doing our job properly. Mm.
That is so funny.
For a long time, I got a great team, and the team delivers, and I'm, just happy to be part of it.
People always suggest going. I live in the suburbs, going downtown, and we always have to remind them we have those same restaurants out here in all the suburbs.
That's right. That's right. If you want a city experience, you come to Winnetka. I'll hook you up.
All right, dude, I'll be there.
He is Chef Michael Lakowitz with Aboye in Winnetka. How can people find out more information about your restaurant and get those reservations in?
So for my group, the George Trois group, that's Aboye and George Trois, all reservations are being taken on Tok, exploretok.com/Aboye or /George Trois, and it's the georgetroisgroup.com. Is our website. You can find all the information on there. And if you want to find out more about all the restaurants that are participating in Restaurant Week, you go straight to eatitupchicago.com, and there's a whole list with all the information. And it's just a really great community of restaurants to be part of, and I'm just really happy and honored to be part of it.
Well, your passion for food and for restaurant comes through loud and clear. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm very shy, and I appreciate you letting me come out.
Retiring chef. Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You as well. Chef Michael Lakowitz is a part of our
Get in Foodie with Bruce and Judy.
Yeah. Aboye in Winnetka.
I'm going to need that steak free.
Oh, my goodness. It looks fantastic as well.
It really does. It really does.
And again, just a genuine passion. You can tell. It comes through. There's some videos on their website, too, of Chef running the kitchen. He's not shy in the kitchen either, by the way. And a good morning to you. A happy Tuesday. Bruce and Judy with you. And you know that 25K payoff contest is underway. Here's how you can win. Just listen at the top of every hour, okay? And listen for that key word. You immediately win $100 and in the grand prize drawing for $25,000. The top of every hour, that's 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. And you could win 25 grand. We got another one coming up, another keyword coming up in 6 minutes and 30 seconds at the tone. Beep. Okay. All right. So you've heard about people that have been paralyzed, right? And had these horrific injuries or diseases where they're unable to move, unable to speak. And, one of the questions for a long time has been, well, what's going on in the brain? Are they still cognizant? Do they still know what's going on? And leave it to scientists. Leave it to scientists in England who maybe found out something kind of interesting using brain implants. So follow me on this. Neuroscientists implanted these little thingy maboobers in the brain of a paralyzed patient. And they described it. I hadn't heard this term before, but they used this term called completely locked in patient, which meant that they had no physical abilities.
But they must have known they had, they had brain waves, obviously.
Brain waves. So they're trying to figure out what's going on. So they implant these implants in this man. And it worked. And he was able to talk. His first words in months, which, by the way, go as an inspiration to most of the guys out there.
Music to my ears.
I want a beer.
Nice. Well, let's think about it. He obviously said the most important thing.
Yeah.
Right? You're going to say your first words. You understand that this is an important thing. What do you say? I want a beer.
It's been the first time that this has ever been. It's pretty groundbreaking if you think about it. First time that they've ever done something like this.
I was thinking about Stephen Hawking and how did he communicate? I think it wasn't this, obviously, but it was something like it because I think he was in the same boat.
He had a disease where he was locked in, completely locked in.
Your brain. You're not moving. You're thinking, right? You're not moving anything except, I guess, your brain.
It's really interesting. It's just fascinating where technology and
crazy
medicine can go as it moves forward. He then, after asking for a beer, his mom was there, by the way. He asked to listen to Tool, the band, went a little heavy metal in there, a little rock, and he wanted a head massage from his mom.
Of course he did.
It's pretty darn amazing. I think it's fantastic, and, you know, what does that open up for a lot of other people who are paralyzed in some way, shape, or form, and can't communicate, you know, can with these implants be able to suddenly communicate again and not be trapped inside their own brain.
Right. He was able to complete sentences at the rate of one character each minute.
Okay.
So it takes a while.
Takes a while, but that technology is going to move forward.
Beer, but you know, it makes it all.
Beer.
Yeah. Marge, yeah. Hear me.
It means more. It's slower and you pay attention more. So.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which it's amazing what we can do. It's just shocking, really, when you think about it, the advances we've made.
Well, yeah, again, and I just think about what this opens up for other people, you know, other folks that are in a similar boat, and them finally being able to communicate again and tell you what's been going on.
Right. And obviously it's not for people in comas.
No.
It's not. It's people who just are paralyzed, can't move anything on their body, but they still have brainwaves.
Right. Still have the ability to think.
Right, to think. Right? Exactly.
Listen, maybe that is enough to restore your faith in humanity, because it's pretty darn cool. Don't get me wrong. Well, guess what? Judy says she can one-up you. She's going to restore your faith in humanity right now.
Well, this is pretty darn cool, too. Those who say there's no such thing as destiny, well, they need to meet Jack Waxall and Sam Ron, victims who met during the Holocaust and who met again 79 years later in South Florida. Whoa. So having endured slave labor shoulder to shoulder in the Pionki labor camp in Poland, the two were separated after Waxall escaped into the forest. Ron was moved to a different camp, and that was ultimately liberated, of course. Neither knew the other had survived until Waxall attended a Holocaust dinner just this past Sunday. He found his old camp friend was the guest speaker. Just teenagers at the time of their imprisonment, the two managed to both migrate to the United States, specifically to Ohio, where they both lived for 40 years, unaware of each other's existence, before eventually moving to South Florida. Those men have a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do they call that? Is that serendipity?
Yeah.
Wow.
Fate, karma.
Wow. Amazing. Thank you for restoring our faith in humanity. Also, thanks a lot to MG and the Posse in Mission Control, hitting all the buttons and making things happen.
Chicken.
March! We also got to thank our infant producer, Miranda, on the other side of the Double Pain Bulletproof Glass, our DJ, Tom. Hush your mouth over there, young man. And Nick Gale, who's sticking around. Concern yourselves not. He's got the news, the traffic, the weather. Nick is going to get you up to speed on everything you need to know to get through your Tuesday just a little bit easier. And he's up next right here on 890 WLS. Don't waste your time.